Hi, listeners, and welcome to the True Crime Weekly podcast, a podcast that is based in San Diego and hosted by me, Alina Trujillo, and my producer, Jose Fernandez. This is a podcast where I will be bringing you stories of murders, infamous cases, and unsolved mysteries. On November 16th, 1971, a young girl with dark hair was seen naked from the waist down by dozens of drivers and commuters on their way out of Rochester. She was running along the breakdown lane of the I-490 West near the Chili Riga exit, desperately trying to get the attention of passerbys as she frantically waved her arms. A car backed up slowly towards her, from which a man exited and proceeded to grab the clearly frightened girl by the arm and led her back to the car. He turned back on the highway and sped away. 38 people witnessed this horrifying sight. However, the first report, shockingly, wasn't reported until 3 days later. Tragically, by this time, the body of 10-year-old Carmen Colon had been discovered. This is the story of the Alphabet Murders. Okay, Jose, so this week's story is actually a request from a crew member, aka a listener. You're not the only one now.
Yay.
Now, this person commented on the episode that you did on the Jamestown Massacre, and they requested that we cover the Alphabet Killer. So, without further ado, let's jump right in.
No, I'm excited.
Mm-hmm. So Carmen originally was from Puerto Rico before she moved to live in one of the poorer areas of Rochester before she went missing. Carmen agreed to run an errand for her mother and go pick up her prescriptions from a local drugstore, but Carmen never returned back home. So the last eyewitness report given was that of Carmen getting into a car, which appeared to be waiting for her after she left a local drugstore. And approximately 50 minutes after Carmen exited the pharmacy, Carmen was reported running along the breakdown lane of the I-490 West near the Chili Riga exit. And she was desperately trying to get the attention of passerbys as she frantically waved her arms. As she's running, trying to get the attention, a car backed up slowly towards her, from which a man exited and proceeded to grab the clearly frightened girl by the arm and led her back to the car. So, Jose, I think you know this. I think I've told you this, but here's a little fun fact. Like, I have seriously had nightmares about this, of me being captured, and then I work up the courage to, you know, try to escape, and then I do, and I run into a car of somebody that's in cahoots with whoever took me, or, like, they catch on to me, and it's like I had that taste of freedom, and it's like now I'm being dragged, like, that is the worst.
That is the worst. That's terrifying. You think you're finally going to be free,
mm-hmm.
and then here we are again.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible. And she's only 10 years old.
She's 10 years old. So after the person grabbed her and put her back in the car, obviously the car just turned right back into the highway and sped away. And the vehicle was believed to be a dark color Ford Pinto hatchback. So 2 days later, the half-naked body of Carmen was found in Churchville by the side of the road. A couple of teenage boys made a discovery, initially mistaking Carmen's body by a mannequin, which you know how we like to say. It's never, ever, ever a mannequin. Unless you're at Herbert Baumeister's pool party, right? Am I correct?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's the only time it's ever going to be a mannequin.
Yeah, that's awful.
Unfortunately, Carmen had been raped and strangled, and her body was covered in scratches. So Carmen's pants were found near the exit of the I-490. Per usual, police obviously started looking at Carmen's family, especially since the eyewitness's report seemed to indicate that Carmen was willing to get in the car of her killer initially when she was leaving the drugstore. So police looked long and hard at Miguel Colon. Miguel, or Uncle Miguel, as he was known to Carmen, was interviewed by police about Carmen's disappearance. So, weeks prior to the abduction and murder of Carmen, Miguel had purchased a car closely matching the vehicle seen by eyewitnesses reversing up Interstate 490 in pursuit of Carmen. So, investigators did conduct a search of Miguel's vehicle shortly after Carmen's murder, discovering that the interior and exterior of the car had been extensively cleaned, and the trunk had been washed with a strong cleaning solution.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's really suspicious.
Right? So, detectives obviously questioned the dealership, which they had recently sold the vehicle to Miguel. And the dealership revealed that the trunk had not been washed with a detergent prior to the sale. So something else that raised suspicion was that a doll belonging to Carmen was found in Miguel's car. But family members told detectives that it wasn't uncommon for Carmen to be in Miguel's car. Therefore, they just thought Carmen could have just easily forgotten the doll in his car. So the family didn't actually see that as suspicion or, you know, thought that Miguel had anything to do with it.
Yeah, that doesn't seem very odd if he's had the car for weeks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But here's something that is odd. So according to a friend, 2 days after Carmen's death, Miguel had informed him of his intention to leave the country as he had, and I quote, done something wrong in Rochester.
What?
Yeah. So Miguel ended up relocating from Rochester to Puerto Rico just 4 days after Carmen's murder.
Oh, man, that's super suspicious, though.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So investigators traveled to San Juan to question Miguel on March of 1972. Although local newspaper published articles detailing police intentions to question him, resulting in Miguel fleeing from authorities.
So he had the heads up already, right? And left.
So Miguel surrendered to authorities on March 26th and agreed to be extradited back to Rochester to face questioning. Mm-hmm. So while Miguel was being questioned, Miguel was unable to provide a credible alibi for his movements on the day of Carmen's murder. Mm-hmm. And no individual could be located to corroborate his claims regarding his whereabouts. So that's suspicious. Despite strong circumstantial evidence attesting to Miguel's guilt, no physical evidence was actually located at the crime scene or within his vehicle to link him to the murder. And Miguel Colon ended up committing suicide in 1991 at the age of 44, following an incident of domestic violence in which he shot and wounded his wife and his brother.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so they could never actually tie him to the murder. And afterwards, you know, he committed suicide. So it's kind of now it's just, you know, we don't know.
Seeing how we're only a few minutes in, I'm guessing he wasn't the killer.
You're beginning to learn?
Yeah. 50 something episodes in, I'm starting to catch on. Mm.
That was fantastic, Jose. You want to know what I just did?
What'd you do?
I opened up the new wine that I received from Wine of the Month Club. So do you, Jose, want to treat yourself or someone special to great wines month after month?
I would love to.
Well, now you can with Wine of the Month Club. With Wine of the Month Club, you get 3 different bottles of rare international wine every month. You get to choose from all red, all white, or mixed. You can also choose to do a package every 2 months or 3 months if that's a better option for you. And every package ships with their monthly newsletter covering your selections and our listener favorites. Fun facts!
We are a proud affiliate, which means if you go to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com/support-the-show and click on the Wine of the Club month link and sign up, we will earn a commission.
You can support the show and get wine delivered to your door by using promo code HOLIDAY15 to get $15 off any 4-month club, or you can use promo code HOLIDAY20 for $20 off any 6-month club, which sounds like a win-win to me. You get to stay home during this COVID-19 pandemic, quarantine by yourself, and your wines.
And they ship free.
What? Hey, Jose. So you know that during this pandemic, it could even be scary to go to the grocery store sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you can save yourself that trip using Instacart. Instacart delivers groceries in as fast as 1 hour. Instacart highlights deals to help you save money. They find everything you usually buy. You can get smart suggestions for new items. They even pick the freshest produce and they keep your eggs safe too.
We are a proud affiliate of Instacart. So head over to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com/support-the-show and click their link.
Then on April 2nd, 1973, at around 5:10 p.m., 11-year-old redhead Wanda Walkovic went to buy some groceries for her mother from the local store. And by 8 p.m. that evening, Wanda had failed to return home. Her mother, desperate with worry, called the police to report her daughter missing. And police immediately launched an investigation search to locate Wanda. And almost 50 detectives searched several square miles of the terrain around her home and areas around the Genesee River where she was known to play.
Okay? Wow, that's a big search party.
Oh, yeah. So these searches, though, they failed to locate Wanda. So get this. Three classmates specifically observed Wanda bracing the bag against the fence so that she could improve her grip upon the bag as a brown vehicle drove past her. So just over 14 hours later, Wanda's mother, Joyce, got a knock on the door that every parent dreads. Wanda's body was discovered by a New York State trooper who was patrolling the rest area at Iron Decoy Bay in Webster, which is approximately 7 miles from Rochester.
It's not too far away at all.
No. So the position of her body, though, indicated that she had likely been thrown from a moving vehicle with her body rolling down the embankment.
Man, these people just don't give. They really don't care.
This story, it's crazy. I want to thank that crew member that wanted us to do this story. Because let me tell you, when I was doing my research, it was in the middle of the day. There was light out. And you know me, usually I like to get into the mood by like having it be dark. Mm-hmm. No, it was in the middle of the day. And this story had me jumping. Like, I was so jumpy at everything. Like, this is just, oh my gosh. Anyways, let's keep going.
Man, it's just terrible. I guess what I'm getting at is just to just dump a body.
And she's 11 years old.
Yeah, that's just, ugh.
Yeah. So unlike Carmen, Wanda was still fully clothed, but it was clearly evident that she had been the victim of sexual assault. So her cause of death was strangulation with the use of ligature. So several defense wounds indicated that Wanda had fought her murderer and that her body had been redressed after death. So the autopsy report revealed traces of semen and pubic hair on Wanda's body. Several strands of white cat fur were also found upon her clothing. Although Wanda's family, though, when they were questioned about this, they didn't own a pet with white fur. So another strange detail was revealed during the autopsy. So Wanda had eaten custard shortly before her murder. And it was felt that the killer must have fed Wanda at some point, as it wasn't an item that she had purchased at the store. And her mom was adamant that it wasn't a food that Wanda would have eaten at home or school. So police had plenty of leads to follow up on. And one in particular was a tip that came in from an anonymous caller saying they had witnessed a young girl they could swear was Wanda being bundled into a Dodge Dart.
Really? So, I mean, you're talking about, like, clearly the killer took Wanda back to maybe a home or wherever close by.
Right.
You know potentially what type of car it is. Mm-hmm. So and it's kind of narrowing down.
This is what kills me about this story. Now, this is the second victim that witnesses saw somebody putting a young girl into a car.
Yeah.
I'm just going to leave it at that.
The first one was 38 people or something like that?
Like, yeah.
38 people? Like, that's...
We're just going to leave that there. But two young girls also told police that on the Saturday before Wanda's murder, that a man attempted to entice them into his vehicle, which happened to be a Ford LTD. So now Dodge and Ford, that's two different cars, right? Mm-hmm. So another caller said he had seen the body actually being dumped. Yet another caller said he saw Wanda crying in a green Pinto driven by a tattooed man. Again,
all over the place.
Right. And none of these calls led to anyone being arrested for the murder. And after continuously finding themselves heading towards dead ends, some optimism finally seemed to appear when police went as far as to indicate that an arrest was imminent. After interviewing an unknown individual who had previously been arrested for child endangerment, for 12 hours, police released their suspect after they passed a polygraph test. You know, a lie detector,
isn't
which
that crazy?
It's
like,
crazy because now
that's like legitimate back then. Right.
And now it's like that is not, you know,
you can't use it.
Yeah. Anybody candidate actually pass a test or fail. You know, that doesn't really indicate anything. But police were back to square one. And in September of 1973, a local television network announced plans to broadcast a televised reconstruction of Wanda's abduction and subsequent recovery of her body. So this 30-minute episode was broadcast on October 21st, asking for witnesses to contact authorities with any information. And although this program resulted in Rochester Police Department receiving over 200 calls from the public, no useful leads came from it. Which, again, is crazy to me. Like, people saw this car, you know?
Yeah. And then,
but
like,
nothing. Everything is just a dead end.
That's interesting. So a televised reconstruction. I mean, Obviously now we're kind of used to something like that.
Right.
Let's say America's Most Wanted or, you know, whatever other program. Mm-hmm. But maybe back then that wasn't necessarily very common, I'm assuming, right?
No, I don't think it was. No.
I got to look that up.
Yeah.
If it's out there.
So 7 months after the murder of Wanda, on November 26, 1973, 10-year-old Michelle Mansa went missing on her way home from school. So investigations would determine that Michelle was last seen by her classmates at approximately 3:20 p.m. She was walking alone en route to a shopping center located close to her school with the intention of getting a purse her mom had left inside a store earlier that day. So approximately 10 minutes later, a witness observed Michelle sitting in the passenger seat of a beige or tan vehicle traveling at high speed on Inkerman Street before turning onto Webster Avenue. So according to this witness, the child had been weeping, and at 5:30 p.m. on November 26th, a motorist observed a man standing by a large beige or tan vehicle with a flat tire parked along Route 350 in the town of Walworth. So this man was holding a girl he strongly believed to be Michelle by the wrist.
Really?
So, yeah. So now get this. When this motorist had stopped to offer assistance, the individual had deliberately grabbed the girl and pushed her behind his back. So he's like trying to hide her. Okay.
Are you kidding?
Well, in doing so, he was also obscuring the license plate from the motorist's view as he stared in his direction with such menacing expression on his face that the motorist had felt compelled to just drive away.
Wow.
I know this. I'm telling you, this just kills me.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, back then, it's not like they had a cell phone. You know, you can just call 911
and
linger around.
That's true. But I mean, come on. Like, you see this at Y and ask questions.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. So unfortunately, Michelle's battered and beaten body would tragically be discovered 2 days after her original disappearance in Macedon, New York. So Michelle was, again, fully clothed, but with obvious signs of sexual assault. Like Carmen and Wanda, she had died from strangulation. As was the case with Wanda, the autopsy again seemed to reveal that Michelle had been fed by her killer. So Michelle's autopsy report revealed that in addition to receiving excessive blunt force trauma to her body, Michelle had been raped, then strangled to death from behind with a ligature, possibly a thin rope.
Really?
Numerous strands of white cat fur were discovered upon her clothing, and leaf samples matching the trees where her body was discovered were recovered from within one of her clutched hands, indicating that she had likely been strangled to death at or near the location where her body was found.
Yeah.
So investigators were able to retrieve a partial palm print from her neck and traces of semen upon her body and underwear. So forensic analysis of the semen samples determined she had been raped by one individual. And analysis of the contents of Michelle's stomach revealed traces of a hamburger and onions, which had been consumed approximately 1 hour before her murder, giving the credence to earlier reports of a girl matching Michelle's description having been seen in company of a Caucasian man with dark hair, aged between 25 and 35, approximately 6 feet tall and weighing 165 pounds, at a fast food restaurant in the town of Penfield at approximately 4:30 p.m. on that afternoon of her disappearance. Mm. So remember how I told you about a witness that had seen a car with a flat tire and he had pulled over trying to help, but, you know, he
yeah.
hit the little girl.
Okay. Right.
Well, that same witness had luckily come across the same beige vehicle he had stopped to help. But this time he was able to get a full license number.
No way.
Yeah. So this led police to an unemployed petty criminal living with his family in Lyons, New York. Okay, so this suspect actually was a good match because he looked like what the witnesses had described the man looked like that they had seen with this little girl.
Okay.
He had also been the owner of the beige sedan witnesses had reported seeing. So despite this, the suspect claimed he had nothing to do with the murders and that he had an alibi. The man's alibi was that he was job hunting all day. And after checking his account of events, telephone records appeared to confirm his story. Though it could just be as easy as, you know, having a family member using the phone, and his family also gave him an alibi.
Right.
So police eventually released the suspect, who has never been named. And after, once again, this guy passes a polygraph.
Ah, freaking polygraph.
So, despite high hopes, police again were at a dead end, and sadly, the trial went cold on the Alphabet murders. And just a week after the death of the final victim of the Alphabet murders, Michelle Maenza, a man held a teenager at gunpoint. The girl refused to stop screaming despite his repeated threats, so the man decided to flee and go on the hunt for an easier target. So, the man in question was a Rochester firefighter named Dennis Termini. At first, Dennis managed to avoid getting captured by police, finally regained his trail and chased Dennis to a parked car. At this point, before he could be apprehended by the officers, guess what?
What?
Dennis had committed suicide by turning his gun on himself.
Oh,
no, that makes me mad each time. I'm telling you, this story, like, every single time, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, what?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I know.
I mean, luckily that girl, though, she didn't stop screaming, she was able to get away.
She's a badass.
That was brave.
Like, despite him, like, shut up, I'm going to kill you. It's like, nope, keep screaming. Like,
yeah, that's,
you know, that's, I mean, brave. To me, it's like, it's the smartest thing. I mean, you know, you don't ever want to find yourself in that situation. But I think that's what I would do, because it's like, I'm not going to stop screaming so you can let me go and I can get help.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if you're going to kill me, I'd rather have you kill me right here, right now, rather than you taking me away and doing who knows what to me.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
Okay, so Dennis owned a beige collar car similar to the one witnesses had reported seeing.
Really?
And yeah, so Dennis also lived just half a mile from Michelle's school. And police had also found a map inside his car with the area where Michelle's body had been dumped. Like, it was folded open to that area.
Really?
Yeah. So his firefighter uniform was also in the car, and this could have explained why the girls seemed willingly to get in the car with Dennis, as they would have seen him as someone they could trust, you know, because all witnesses said that it seemed like the girls at one point, you know, willingly got into these cars.
Right.
Initially, they just, witnesses thought, oh, somebody's there to pick up that little girl, you know. Police would confirm Dennis Termini as the garage rapist. But that was all they could confirm. His known victims as the garage rapist were between the ages of 18 and 21, which was one area of major doubt as to whether he could have also been responsible for the Alphabet murders. So in 2007, any doubt as to his innocence was cast aside as progressions in DNA testing proved that Dennis was not responsible for the murders of Carmen, Wanda, and Michelle. So another possible suspect as to who was the Alphabet killer was Kenneth Bianchi, a Rochester, New York native that was one half of the Hillside Strangler, who was responsible for the deaths of 10 women between 1977 and 1978.
No way.
Yeah. So, okay, get this. Kenneth was caught when he committed a pair of murders without his partner, Angela Buono. So Kenneth was still living in Rochester at the time of the Alphabet murders, and he was also employed as an ice cream vendor, a security guard, and an ambulance driver, all which would have provided Kenneth with uniforms, which would have made him seem approachable to a young girl, right? So there was also forensic evidence from the crime scene of Wanda's murder, which could be only found present in 20% of males, and Kenneth's profile fell in this 20%.
Really?
Yeah. So all this seemingly made Kenneth a very good suspect. And police decided to match a wrist print they had obtained from Michelle's Maenza's murder and compared it to Kenneth. However, it wasn't a match. Okay, Jose, and here's another fun fact for you. I'm on a roll. That was in the fun fact. Okay, so here's a fun fact. Did you know that wrist prints can change over time? So,
really?
Yeah. So as the skin alters and loses elasticity, and keep in mind, there was a 10-year gap between when the print was made as to when it was compared to Kenneth. So really? That could have changed. Interesting. Okay? That's a fun fact.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So to this day, police still consider Kenneth as a possible suspect in the Alphabet murders. But Kenneth, on the other hand, is adamant he had nothing to do with the murders of Carmen, Wanda, and Michelle, and has told police in the past to either charge him with the murders or leave him alone, as he's tired of being linked to these murders that he denies having anything to do with. But keep in mind that Kenneth also denies being the Hillside Strangler.
Interesting. So he's denying everything.
Right. Okay. So let me tell you about another suspect that I did my research on that completely gave me the creeps. I was so jumpy when I was reading on this guy. So on April 11th, 2011, police arrested 77-year-old Joseph Nasso and charged him with the murders of four women. His victims were Roxanne Ruggish, Pamela Parsons, Tracy Tafoya, and Carmen Colon. No relation to the Rochester victim, okay? These were all sex workers, and due to the double initial names of his victims, these crimes were referred to as the Alphabet Murders of California. So during a search of Joseph's home, police found a disturbing journal that Joseph had kept. In the journal, he wrote about how he overpowered, raped, and killed 10 victims.
What?
Yeah. So eventually, two more of these victims would be identified as Sarah Dillon and Sheree Patton. Unfortunately, the other four women remain unidentified. And Joseph had also numerous pictures of women in various states of undress, all seemingly unconscious, some of which were found to be his murder victims. So not only was Joseph linked to the double initials of his victims and those in Rochester Alphabet murders, but also because his MO was to offer a ride in his vehicle before murdering his victims. Obviously, similar to how police believe the Rochester Predator entices victims, right?
I mean, yeah, that's such a... I mean, it seems like this is an ongoing thing with serial killers, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. So police also saw him as the possible Alphabet killer, as Joseph Nasso was born in Rochester, New York, and lived there for many years, including the time period when the young girls were murdered.
Yeah, it's all kind of like linking together. It's making sense.
Right. But he was cleared of the Rochester murders when DNA evidence cleared him of the crimes.
My God, another monster's out there, and it's not even the same one.
I know.
It's like one after another. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when I was doing my research on this guy, I read that when police did a search of his home, an officer spotted a pair of, guess what?
What?
Mannequin legs.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so the mannequin legs turned upside down and fitted with nylon stockings. And, like, this is how I picture it in my mind that it goes, like, here comes the cop, you know, like, gun up. And it, like, looks, sees the mannequin, and then it's, like, looks at the guy, like, WTF, like, what is this?
Yeah, what is this about?
Right? And then Joseph said that he wore women's pantyhose because of a skin condition on his leg. And then I can just see the police officer, like, looking down at his legs, and the guy's wearing socks. No, like, legit, the guy was wearing socks. So, like, the officer, like, obviously made a note of that. So upon the same search, Joseph's home, police also found what officers called a rape diary.
Oh, that is creepy.
No, 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 no. I'm going to read you some of the stuff, okay?
Okay.
Now, this is creepy. So one entry said, and I quote, "Girl in North Buffalo Woods. She was real pretty. Front seat of my car. Had to knock her out first. 1958, end quote. Another entry said, and I quote, "Selena, Kansas girl. I followed and met at Fred Astaire dance studio. She was gorgeous. Great legs and nylons. Heels. Had to rape her in my car on a cold wintry night. Snowstorm." End quote.
What the heck?
So there was all these entries that were just like that. So Joseph's house held another secret. At one end was a room with a bolt on the door that could only be opened from the outside.
Okay, that's super creepy. Right.
In the middle of the door was a small flap, the kind that like typically you would find in like prison cells so that the food and other items can be passed through.
Yeah.
So the window was the only one in the house fitted with metal bars, that particular window.
Yeah.
So Joseph said, and get this, in court, that prosecutors were misunderstanding his use of the word rape. He said, in my culture and where I come from, it's a term of making out, scoring, getting to first base. I use that term loosely, which he meant it's because he's from New York.
Is that a thing? I don't think it's a thing.
That is not a thing. Watch us get all these emails from New York people saying that's a thing. Okay, so here's something else that I found like seriously with this guy. Every time he was also questioned in court about the pictures, he would get agitated. And he said he didn't understand the obsession that detectives had with his pictures. Because when he was questioned about these pictures that he had of these women, that detectives even noted that some of them, you can tell that the skin wasn't like, it didn't look real, which meant that the girl was deceased in these pictures. Oh. And the guy was like, why are you so obsessed with my pictures? Like, this is just art. Like, it's...
Oh, he's an artist.
Like these girls knew I was taking a picture of them. But they want to make it seem to something that's not. I don't understand the obsession. So now it's like, oh, the police is obsessed with his pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to see here.
No, nothing. The bolted room with the bars and nothing. The... No, nothing. Yeah, that's not... That's not weird.
That's normal.
So what happened to that guy?
I told you. The DNA didn't match.
So he's out free. Like, well, he's
no,
out.
No. He is currently serving death row. Because remember, he did commit 10 other murders.
Okay.
So no.
Sorry, there's so many murderer serial killers that you just went over. Right? It's hard to focus on
crazy.
One.
Okay? It's crazy. But as far as the alphabet murders go, they still remain unsolved to this day. And like always, you know me, I hope that, you know, in the advances that we constantly have in DNA and how forensics is always evolving, I hope that one day the alphabet killer is caught. And, you know, if he was caught already or if it was one of the suspects that we just went over, you know, like, I hope that at least we'd be able to determine that so we can have a name to this killer.
Yeah, linked to these poor victims. I mean, It's awful. I can't believe I honestly didn't know that. At the end of this guy was not going to be caught yet.
Yeah, no, the case is still shocked. Open. If you want to look at pictures and want more information on the cases we cover, you can head over to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at Podcast True Crime Weekly. And don't forget to support the show by going to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com. And I would truly love it and appreciate it if you would leave a 5-star review and subscribe onto Apple Podcasts. The only way that people find out about us is through subscribers and reviews. Thanks for listening.